You're listening to The Naked Truth, Queer Artist Interviews. I'm Peter, your host, and together we're going to sit down and unzip with some amazing creators and learn the naked truth about their work, their lives, and what it means to make art as a queer person. Thanks for joining. This show explores the area of human sexuality and contains some adult content. Today I am joined by Chaotic Couture. They are a non-binary, genre-bending rapper, DJ, and resident MC of Baltimore's queer dance party, Version. Chaotic has been a featured DJ at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, and their music video is currently exhibited in the Baltimore Museum of Art. Chaotic, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a real pleasure to listen to your music, both on Spotify and SoundCloud. And the references to Baltimore are not always happy in some of your songs, like right. Kids on North Ave and Go Off. But there's something wonderful about hearing Baltimore sung into your music. So can you talk about just how you got started with music? And I don't know if you're from Baltimore, but just the whole Chaotic Couture origin story.
Perfect. So I'm actually from the Eastern Shore originally. So I grew up in a really small town, and Baltimore is kind of like the closest city. So, you know, we get Baltimore radio stations and everything like that. And where I grew up, I was kind of in the middle of Baltimore and Philly. They were both the same distance in different directions. But I mean, Baltimore is Maryland. So you just have like that Maryland connection. So of course, I just leaned more towards Baltimore. And I wanted to be an author actually when I was little. So I used to write a lot. And then I remember my mother listening to TLC, and I wanted to be a singer. And I was like, but I'm not a very good singer. So I just remember Left Eye. And Left Eye is actually one of the reasons that I started rapping. And then discovering Missy Elliott, I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. So one day, my friends and I in eighth grade just like wrote a song. And then when I got into high school, my high school had a radio station. So I used to do all my broadcasting work, and then we would record music after, like post it on MySpace, and I DJed at an under 21 club, so I would play our songs at the club on the weekends, and that was kind of like my origin of getting music started.
That's crazy, actually. Like, that's kind of awesome that you had a radio station at your high school.
Yeah, I had a lot of access that I recognize that a lot of people don't have, and I want to say, if I'm not mistaken, our high school was the only school, and I believe still remains the only high school in Maryland to have a radio station. So getting to learn that, and then I went to school for radio broadcasting when I graduated. So I just kind of continued that and teaching myself DJing and things like that. The skill set was there. So I learned how to use these specific programs. And then from that, I was like, okay, since I have this knowledge, let me use that to teach myself something else. So that's kind of how I came into DJing. I just bought a controller and I was like, I'm going to start DJing.
Well, you know, if you can dream it, be it.
Right.
You said like you recorded a song with your friends that you'd written and you played it at an under 21 club where you had been DJing. Did you get sort of instant feedback there? Was that an experience that made you go, hey, I can do this?
Yeah. So it started because MySpace was the big social media platform. So it started on MySpace, and really we posted this song and we added them to our profiles, not thinking that anybody was like, we hoped, but we didn't think that anybody was going to really pay attention. There was only like maybe a couple other kids in our town who did music and like recorded it. So it was like, oh, everybody was listening, because it just spread around school that we did music. So then when I started, like we started performing at the under 21 club, of course, everybody loved it because it was like, this is the first time you see people that you know making something and then like performing it. And we were redoing like popular songs at the time. So it was like people were already loving that song. So yeah, that was my first taste of it. And then seeing people's feedback, I was like, oh, I can actually do this.
So then you got a degree in recording technology or broadcasting. I'm not going to get the terminology right.
So I took it as a trade. So it's closed down now, the Broadcasting Institute of Maryland. So I really just got kind of like a cosmetology license in a way, without the license and without having to take like state boards. It's like, hey, you put in enough hours to go and do this, so you can go do it. So from there, while I was in broadcasting school, I actually got picked up to be a production intern at 92Q. So then I'm working at this radio station and producing commercials at a radio station that I listened to like my whole childhood. And then that's where I was kind of learning the workings of making music. And because I was in a group, I was the only person who was in Baltimore at the time. So I was like, all right, if I want to keep doing this, I'm going to have to do it by myself. And really, to be honest, besides like Left Eye and Missy Elliott, I didn't listen to a lot of rap when I was younger. I listened to a lot of like pop music. So I also wanted to prove to myself that I could do it without like the ideas coming in from the group. So I was like, I'm just going to do this. And for a while, I was in a group with another friend of mine. And what we would do was do our own solo songs, but we were a group. So we would release mixtapes as a group where we just each did our own songs. So I just kept kind of going like that for a while. And then when I knew I wanted to move back to Baltimore, I was like, okay, let me just go hard with making my own music.
Sure. So if we're talking about DJing and also composing, producing rap, if you can just talk about some of the mechanics of what goes into either DJing, being up there and working with the music while it's playing, or writing, producing, and creating a rap song.
So for me, when it comes to DJing, there's a common misconception I think a lot of people have that is, to DJ, you don't need to pay attention. Like, you don't need a lot of focus. So a lot of times you'll get people come up and like try to talk to you and like get requests and things like that. But knowing the art of DJing, it is a very intricate skill. And it does require a lot of attention and a lot of like hand-eye coordination. So there's certain things, because I am a visual person, sometimes when I'm DJing, I just can see certain things in the wave formats as I'm DJing and be like, okay, I know this is coming here. I know that I can do this. And that just comes from practice. And it's kind of a beautiful thing. I never had any classical training when it came to music. So nobody taught me how to write music. Nobody taught me how to read music or anything like that. So it's kind of a beautiful thing when you, like, you don't know the technical side of things, then it gives you more room to create. So even with producing music, it's like, you know, I don't know how these things should technically be assembled. I don't know the music theory, but I know that this sounds good here and this sounds good here. And it's an emotion. So I think it's more of like, for me, emotional creation, because I just feel it out and I'm like, okay, this feels right.
One of the things that's so amazing about recording technology is the way it gives people access to an interface where they can create and learn about music. That doesn't mean you have to take a bunch of years of piano lessons or necessarily engage with the Five Line staff or stuff like that. So just to dive in a little deeper then, how did you discover music as something that was an important vehicle for expression for you?
So it really all started for me with broadcasting. Like, I knew I wanted to go into radio, and then it was like, oh, these things can work into this. Like, there's a way for me to make everything that I want to do make sense. And when I did play at the Under 21 Club, I was lucky enough to have somebody, Tizra, who did majority of my production from the time I started. And we still work together frequently now. He did all of my EP Abstract, which is like 3 tracks, crazy production. He heard me perform and he was like, hey, I make music, so I want to like work with you. So then I learned and picked up things from him as well. But with me not really seeing representation for myself growing up, there were no limits of what I had to do. So I was like, okay, I know that I love writing. I wanted to be an author. So most authors paint pictures with their words. So I'm going to tie all of my interests into one thing. If I'm going to be rapping, I'm very inspired by spoken word poetry. So I'm going to create these images with my music. So it was really just like, I'm going to take all of these interests that I have and I'm going to like cram them into one thing and I'm going to make it mine. Thinking back, I didn't really see limitations. I was just like, this is what I'm going to do. And then I went and did it.
If we're talking about representation, I'm going to bring up a question that I'd wondered if it was worth asking earlier, which is, I think of the Eastern Shore, I think of it as a pretty white place.
You are right.
So in terms of your experience in grade school, high school, there were enough friends and people interested in rap around you to be able to explore that a little bit. But can you just talk about the aspect of feeling underrepresented as part of your experience and how that has informed your artistic journey?
So growing up in a place like the Eastern Shore is very interesting because my mother is white. So growing up, I had all these microaggressions that I didn't realize were microaggressions. It was always like, you know, we don't really like black people, but because your mom is white, or I was the token Black friend where I was the exception. And you get that a lot as a kid. And my parents didn't really highlight to us, like me or my siblings, that that was wrong. So when that's like the regular interaction that you're having with people, you think that it's right. And then when I started to, you know, you go through the puberty ages and, you know, you hit your growth spurts and you start to change. It's like, oh, now that I am coming into my own as an individual, people are focusing on my race more. So when they were categorizing me as a kid, of course, before I was really identifying myself, it went from you're a kid to you're a Black man. Like it was a switch. And I saw the difference in how I was treated once people started to identify me different. And when that did happen, it was kind of like a rebirth because majority of my friends left my life. And the only people that I had were Black people. Like it was Black women who built me back up. If really it was like I was cradled and it was like, it's okay. Like you're fine. You're going to be okay. So it was then when I found my new tribe of like my family. These people are my family and these people have been in my life for 10 plus years. It was like, oh, I never really fit in with everybody else because I'm not like them. So then it was like, oh, my identity, I've been trying to fit in these white spaces and do these white things. And then it's like, I found, I guess, in a weird way, I found my Blackness when I was around those puberty ages. So then, of course, you know, everything starts to change. My best friend had just moved here from Georgia. So she was listening to a lot of like Gucci Mane and OJ the Juice Man and like Down South music. So I'm like, okay, I hear this. But then I also hear like Baltimore club music. But then I remember how Left Eye used to rap and I knew the music that Missy Elliott made. So when I initially started making music, I was like, I want to make something that all of my friends who enjoy all these different genres of music can like. So that was really like finding my identity was I had all these different experiences and I had all these different layers of who I was. And I just wanted to be representation for people around me who didn't feel as though they had representation. So it kind of just became my mission to be everything for someone that never saw themselves in anybody.
Will I ever be good enough?
Exactly, which is still like a common reoccurrence. It's like, okay, as I'm changing and as I'm going through life, like, am I ever going to be good enough? Am I ever going to be perfect for anybody? But it's like, you know, when you're good enough for yourself, that is your answer. You will be good enough. So it's a journey, but it's been an amazing and insightful one.
When you say, you know, you want to make music for all your friends to enjoy, the friends who accepted you mm-hmm. through that journey of your own self-realization, it's powerful to hear the way in which you've been talking about your experiences and then thinking about particular songs from Diary of a Dreamer.
Yes.
Especially Grammy Speech. That's probably my favorite track of the year that I've listened to yet, but there's some really difficult lines in there in which I feel like you might be addressing your mother in those lines, sort of about you did your best, even though it hurt.
So in Grammy Speech, actually, I think it's still the first verse. Grammy Speech is an open letter to my family and my friends. Mm-hmm. So there are certain lines in there that are dedicated to a lot of people, specifically my parents. I kind of more good enough. They're addressed more in good enough. In Grammy Speech, I spoke a lot about my cousin who, you know, we were really close when we were growing up. But, you know, as you get older, you start going separate ways and you live X amount of miles away from each other. And, you know, she had kids and I was so excited when she had kids because I was like, ah, like I have cousins. And then it was like, damn, you know, I didn't really live up to the expectations that I had for myself. And like, you know, I tried, but like, I hope you accept my apology as I grow that I wasn't there the way that I wanted to be.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little more about your full album, Diary of a Dreamer, just because it's really powerful and has a wonderful through line. If we're talking from a kind of conceptual level, where so much of it, at least in my mind, I see it as about being loved and what that means, how we search for it, and how we apologize when we don't feel like we've done well enough. And sometimes those apologies are actually kind of us forgiving other people for the apology we'll never get from them.
Yes, that is a big thing within the theme of that project. Diary of a Dreamer is a title that I had for a long time since I did my first mixtape. And I was like, okay, this doesn't really fit anything that I'm working on yet. So I already had As I Dream that I had recorded like years ago. And again, it didn't fit the format of any projects I was doing, because when I was doing full projects, they were mostly club music. So I was like, all right, next project I do, it's going to be based completely around As I Dream. So that was kind of like the catalyst for everything. And it's funny that you said that in the explanation of what the project made you feel, because I was going through a lot with my family at the time. So Diary of a Dreamer for me was a way to literally let go of everything that was inside of me to be like, this is all out on the table. And it really was me accepting the apologies from my family that I was never going to get. So I was like, you know, once I put this to music, once I put it out, it's a done deal. So I did As I Dream. And then the first track I produced for it was Purple Hearts. And I was opening for the band Denmate at Metro Gallery. And I did a snippet of Purple Hearts. And the person who runs Babe City, which is the record label that Denmate is on, came up to me after and was like, hey, we loved your set. Would you want to put out a project with us? So I was like, sure. So I had As I Dream, I had Purple Hearts. And then I was like, all right, I have to do the rest of this project. So I really just kind of took songs and beats that I had scrapped and didn't really do anything with. And I reworked them and I made it a project.
It works so well together, but I appreciate the deep dive into how it was made, because I think it's important to see how the sausage is made. If yes. You look at it from the outside, it's like clear concept album. I want to bring sexuality into this just a little bit, because I'm sure that might be another entire can of worms in which expectations were defied. Expectations that you grew up with, expectations from your family. And I don't know how much that part of your journey was something for which you might not ever get an apology.
So the biggest thing about identity is I think there's always this misconception that once you have it figured out, that's it. It's like, okay, once you identify this one time, like that's what you have to stick to. And I think the beautiful thing about younger kids who are coming of age now is there's a level of access to language that we didn't have when we were younger, that I didn't have when I was younger. So I always knew that I was different than everybody else around me, but I was like, I don't exactly know how I identify, because this doesn't fit, but this is the closest thing that I know, so I'll go with this. Sexuality was something I was always aware of from as far back as I can remember. Like, there's pictures of me as a kid, like, holding Barbie dolls. And it's like, I was always more feminine. And when I knew that I wanted to rap, I knew that I had to be better than everybody else. I knew that I had to be on top of my game because the fact that I was queer. And when I got older and I started taking music more serious, I would send out like press releases and everything. And I would be like, I'm Chaotic Couture. I'm a gay rapper. And I still thank him to this day for that. DDM, who is one of my dearest friends, he pulled me up and he said, stop telling people that you're a gay rapper. It does nothing for you and it does nothing for them. I felt that I was doing something more. And he was like, you're dope. Just let it be that you're a rapper. And let them define you or do whatever the way that they want to do. Know who you are, but just be amazing at what you do. So when he told me that, I kept that and I kept sharpening my skill, because I would see people, and this is in no way being cocky, but I did theater a lot in high school too. So I know about like performing and I was trained in doing that a lot. So I would see people, I was like, I'm a better writer than this person, or I'm a better performer than this person, and I'm not getting these opportunities. And I knew a lot of it was because of my identity. So I was like, okay, if I'm not getting the shows and I'm not getting the performances, I'm going to work on my skill. I'm going to work on my writing. And when I do get an opportunity, I'm going to be so great that they can't deny me. And that is just all wrapped up in my identity, because being Black in general, Black people know, like you hear all the time, you have to be 50 times better than everybody else to get half as much. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I had to go harder. I knew that I always had to be on top of my game. I knew that everything had to be right just by being Black, even doing music. And then I knew being queer on top of that, I had to be 100% on top of that 50 for people to take me serious, because when they see me, they've already written me off. So now I'm like, I have to be so skilled in a way that if somebody denies my talent, you have to know that they're just a hater. Like, it's okay to say that you don't like my music, but there's no way that you cannot say that I'm not talented. That was always my thing. I was like, there's going to be no way that somebody can say with confidence, Chaotic Couture is not talented.
It's funny that you bring up DDM, and also that he kind of actively discouraged, maybe it's a matter of like how you're presenting in terms of marketing, as you said, like for press releases, stuff mm-hmm. like that.
I think it was one of those things where it was like, don't be ashamed of who you are. But I think especially at the time, like, I don't think that that was a conversation that if we met in this point in time, that's probably not something that he would say to me. But for the time that we were in, it was like, there was no Leaf. There was no Cakes the Killer. There was nobody out there doing it. So basically what he was trying to tell me was, don't give them the opportunity to not listen to you before they even listen to you, because you've told them that you're somebody that they don't like.
Sure.
Yeah. So it was like, I knew from the time that I met him in 2010, but yeah, in 2012, that's when like the articles with him and TT and things came out like that. So it was like, even when they knew, they weren't pushing that as a story because it was nothing to be celebrated.
Sure. Can you talk then a little more about how you found a community of queer rap and how you found a community here? You'd already had a first loss of community at home through your adolescence. And so can you talk about how that happened in Baltimore?
Of course. So the beautiful thing about losing everything that you've known at a young age is once it happens, nothing can affect you in that way again. So knowing that I had lost everything that I knew about the people around me and support system that I created growing up, I was never scared to do that again. So I started coming to Baltimore, going to the Paradox, Super Third Saturdays with the LGBT night. And, you know, all of my friends are like, we want to go. They're trying to find boyfriends. They're like, I want to be seen. I want to be cute. I'm like, all right, that's cool and all that. But after I went for the first time and I saw people that looked like us that I had never heard of, but they were on stage performing, I was like, y'all can have it. That's what I'm here for. So when we started going to the docks, I was trying to figure out who the promoters were, found the promoters, followed them on Twitter, hit them up, sent them my music. And I just kind of did that and made sure that when we went to the Paradox, the promoter knew that I was there. The promoter knew who I was. And it was just one of those things. And we went for a good year and a half, I think, before I ever performed. And then finally, I remember it like it was yesterday. It was a 420 show. And in the back room where they used to do the balls called the Chamber, they were like, we're doing a show back there. And that is where I met Rovo Monty. That is where I saw TT for the first time. I'd heard TT's name, but that's where I saw TT for the first time. And that was my first time performing. So I came up in the Paradox and seeing these other like queer performers around me. And then by the time I moved here in 2015, the Paradox was closing. So first thing I did, I hit up DDM and I was like, all right, I have no idea what to do. Like, I came here to work on my music, but now the only place that I've known is closing. So I don't know what to do. And he said, you need to get in the Station North scene. If you get into the Station North scene, you will be fine, you will be amazing, and you will flourish. So then I did the same thing I did the first time. I said, okay, just give me a name. And I believe the name that he gave me at the time was Adam Schwartz. So I followed Schwartz. From Schwartz, I see, okay, these parties, who are the names of people on these parties? From these parties, who's doing their own thing? Where are these parties happening? And then that's how I came across Abdu, and that's how I formally met TT, and then just knowing DDM. And again, just about being out when I moved here, TT got the Section 1 stage for Artscape. And it was in a parking lot on Maryland Avenue. And I did that show. And I remember I have the video somewhere, but when I got done like my acapella opening, you just hear TT saying, oh shit, like they can rap. So TT kind of like always hit me up after that. And She did a show with Abdu. They combined Kalan and TT. They worked together and they did an event during Pride called Cunt Fest in the Crown, where they took the Red Room and the Blue Room, completely queer, put on all these different artists. And I performed at Cunt Fest in the Blue Room for the very first time. And from that performance, for every weekend for a year straight, I was either booked performing or I was booked hosting all over the city, and especially in the Crown. And that's how things really grew for me.
Skyrocketed, it sounds like.
Yes. So I thank TT for that all the time. And she'll tell me, like, you don't have to thank me. Like, I just threw the party. You brought your talent. And I'm like, but it takes somebody to open up that space for people to get exposure.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little more about, I feel like there's a certain distance in the content of your tracks and of your songs in talking about your sexuality or not. So can you talk about the ways in which you feel your sexuality informs your work? Clearly, it's informed your network, and that's an incredibly significant way in which one's sexuality informs your artwork.
Well, in the beginning, it was never in the cards for me to write a love song or anything like that, because when you look at the world, especially in hip hop, it's like, okay, I have the strike of being queer against me, so nobody's going to want to hear that, is what you tell yourself, because you haven't heard it. Then within being queer, the different facets that come with that identity is like, okay, not only am I queer, but I'm queer, I'm black, and I'm fat. So nobody's going to want to envision me in a romantic way. So in the beginning, it was just like, it's all punchlines. Like, I'm going to rap. It's all going to be this. So I'm going to throw like certain lingo in there. Like, I'm going to have like shade, and I'm going to have reading, and I'm going to have different like queer slang in there, so that when queer people hear this, they're like, yes, I can relate. And I kind of wanted it to go over like straight people's head before like queer lingo got hijacked. But I was like, you know, I'm never going to really like write a love song or anything, because nobody's going to want to hear that. And then my best friend, who I spoke about earlier, Georgia, Keisha, her brother actually told me one time, he was like, you know, you literally have a song about everything, but you need a love song. Like, you haven't written any like love songs. So again, when I went into Make a Diary of a Dreamer, I was like, okay, I'm going to at least reference love in some type of way. So that's why, like, in the hook of Good Enough, it's like, I'm going to be vulnerable. Like, will I ever find my love? Like, will I find myself? I don't know. But this is at least going to be the introduction to me speaking about that. Because again, if I'm feeling this way, there's other people who share my intersections who probably feel the same way. Being from the Eastern Shore, like being in such a small place, you don't experience a lot of queer people. And if you do, they're usually older. So I just, those years where everybody was dating and you're finding out who you like and what you like and what you're into and all those things, I didn't have that. So like, I'm still experiencing that as an adult. So when I did have those moments of like, okay, I'm opening myself up to people, because you know, nowadays where you're meeting people on these apps and I'm talking to people, and it's like, sometimes I think there's a pressure when you get on these apps to lose yourself in a way, to feel wanted by someone. So yeah, that's especially like the second verse. I was like, you know, do I want to lose who I am just to get this attention of somebody who, if we hook up, I may never see or talk to again? Like, do I want to lose all that I am for that? And the answer is no.
And nor should you have to.
Right.
Well, you've given me a wonderful transition, musician, of course, into one of the mainstay questions of the podcast. And so I'd love to frame your experience in terms of being naked. So let's think about where you can be chaotic, where you can even be the person who goes by chaotic. Mm-hmm. Where do you feel comfortable being naked? This can be as literal or figurative as you want.
Honestly, it's funny because, you know, like I said, doing theater, people always say, like, when you have stage fright, envision everyone in the crowd naked. But on stage is where I feel I'm able to be the most stripped down, the most naked, because although it comes with being very vulnerable a lot of times, there's something amazing about feeling that energy and feeling that rush. But at the same time, having those stage lights on you, so it's like, you know, there are people on the other side, but you can't directly see them. And you're literally just maneuvering off the energy in the room. That is when I feel I am the most free, the most myself is when I'm on stage in those moments.
There's a kind of barrier there, a kind of safety where it's not so easy to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's imagine a world where the US and the world has gotten COVID-19 under control to the point where we can safely be out there mingling with people and in the world. In that happy future, what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to physically embracing people again because I'm a firm believer of energy. So I'm like, seeing people that I care about and who I love and actually getting to like physically embrace them, I miss that a lot. And I also just miss, you know, there's a lot of hectic things, no pun intended. There's a lot of chaos in the world. And there's just something about going out, even like with emceeing version, it's something about knowing that you're going to see individuals, like knowing I'll see someone on every second Saturday. And if they're not in that room, knowing to check on them and be like, hey, is everything okay? Because I didn't see you here this time. Mm-hmm. So it's like physically embracing people, but also just knowing that for a certain amount of time, even if everything else is going on in the world, that people are safe and secure. Like I miss that because I feel like that's what music and that's what shows and that's what parties provide to people.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for such an amazing interview, Chaotic. And I'm going to keep listening to your music. I encourage everyone listening to subscribe to your SoundCloud, your Bandcamp, any number of ways that people can engage with you. Watch music videos on YouTube. Stay safe and stay well.
Thank you. You as well. And thank you for encouraging people to listen because you never know. There just might be something new coming, even with COVID around.
Absolutely. Thanks for spending some time with us on The Naked Truth. If you want to learn more about this episode's artist, be sure to look through the links in the podcast description. Please consider how you can support the creative people on this show and in your community. Art helps us all get through. And that's The Naked Truth.